listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. This week, we'll preview new titles from a group I'm calling Ladies in the Lineup. These thriller writers, some old favorites and others new to the group, are at the top of their game and in every way equal to their male counterparts. These women have created page-turners where details accumulate, tensions build, and misdirection abounds. Intricate plot lines and fascinating characters populate each page and each chapter. My guest, Sandra Brown, stops by to speak about Friction, the latest in her long line of bestsellers. So settle in and get ready for fiendishly clever thrillers with unexpected twists and turns around every corner. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. What should be a cozy, fun-filled weekend in the English countryside takes a sinister turn in Ruth Ware's In a Dark, Dark Wood. Leonora, known to some as Lee and others as Nora, is a reclusive crime writer, unwilling to leave her apartment unless it's absolutely necessary. When a friend she hasn't seen or spoken to in years unexpectedly invites her to a weekend away, she reluctantly agrees to make the trip. 48 hours later, Leonora wakes up in a hospital bed, injured but alive, with the knowledge that someone is dead. Wondering not what happened, but what have I done, Leonora tries to piece together the events of the past weekend. Working to uncover secrets, reveal motives, and find answers, she must revisit parts of herself she would much rather leave buried in the past. Imogen Church performs the book.
Nina and I looked at each other. My heart was thudding like a stray echo of the door knocker, but I tried to keep my face calm. 10 years. Had she changed? Had I changed? I swallowed. There was the sound of Flo's feet echoing on the high atrium of the hallway, then metal shrieking on metal as she opened the heavy door, followed by the murmur of voices as whoever it was came into the house. I listened carefully. It didn't sound like Claire. In fact, beneath Flo's laugh, I could hear something that sounded distinctly male. Nina rolled over and raised herself up on one elbow. "Well, well, well. Sounds like the fully Y-chromosomed Tom has arrived." "Nina..." "What? What are you looking at me like that for? Should we go downstairs and meet the cock in the hen house?" "Nina, don't." "Don't what?" She swung her feet to the floor and stood up. "Don't embarrass us."
"Him." "If we're hens, naturally that makes him a cock.
I'm using the term in its purely zoological sense."
"Nina."
But she was gone, loping down the glass stairs in her stockinged feet, and I heard her voice floating up the stairwell.
"Hello, don't think we've met."
"Don't think we've met." Well, it definitely wasn't Claire then. I took a deep breath and followed her down into the hallway. I saw the little group from above first. By the front door was a girl with smooth, shiny black hair tied in a knot at the base of her skull, presumably Melanie. She was smiling and nodding at something Flo was saying, but she had a mobile in her hand and was poking distractedly at the screen, even while Flo talked. On the opposite side was a bloke, Burberry case in hand. He had smooth chestnut hair and was immaculately dressed in a white shirt that must have been professionally laundered. No normal person could produce creased sleeves like that. And a pair of grey wool trousers that screamed Paul Smith. He looked up as he heard my feet on the stairs and smiled.
"Hi, I'm Tom."
"Hi, I'm Nora." I forced myself down the last few steps and held out my hand. There was something incredibly familiar about his face, and I tried to figure out what it was while we shook, but I couldn't place it. Instead, I turned to the dark-haired girl. "And you must be Melanie?"
"Hi, yeah."
She looked up and gave a flustered smile.
"Sorry, I left my six-month-old at home with my partner. First time I've done it, I really wanted to call home and check in. Isn't there any reception here?"
"Not really," Flo said apologetically. Her face was flushed with nerves or excitement, I wasn't sure which.
Sorry. You can sometimes get a bit from the top end of the garden or the balconies, depending on what network you're on. But there's a landline in the living room. Let me show you. She led the way through, and I turned back to Tom. I still had an odd feeling I'd seen him somewhere before. So, how do you know Claire? I asked awkwardly.
Oh, you know, theatre connections. Everyone knows everyone. It was actually through my husband originally. He's a director. Nina gave me a theatrical wink behind Tom's back. I frowned furiously and then rearranged my face as I saw Tom looking puzzled.
Sorry, go on, Nina said seriously.
Anyway, I met Claire at a fundraiser for the Royal Theatre Company. Bruce was directing something there. We just got talking shop.
You're an actor? Nina asked.
No, playwright.
It's always strange meeting another writer. A little feeling of camaraderie, a Masonic bond. I wonder if plumbers feel like this, meeting other plumbers, or if accountants give each other secret nods. Maybe it's because we meet comparatively rarely. Writers tend to spend the bulk of their working life alone.
Nora's a writer, Nina said. She eyed us both as if unleashing two bantamweights into the ring to scrap it out.
Oh, really? Tom looked at me as if seeing me for the first time.
What do you write?
Ugh, the question I hate. I've never got comfortable talking about my writing. Never got over that feeling of people riffling through my private thoughts. Fiction, I said vaguely.
We've just heard In a Dark, Dark Wood by Ruth Ware. Sandra Brown is the author of more than 60 New York Times bestsellers. If you've read even one of them, you know she's a writer who grabs you from page one. Sandra began her writing career in 1981. Since then, her books have been translated into 34 languages, with upwards of 80 million in print worldwide. Sandra holds an honorary doctorate of humane letters from Texas Christian University, where she and her husband, Michael Brown, have instituted the ELF, a scholarship annually awarded to a student pursuing a fiction writing career. In 2008, she was named Thriller Master, the top award given by the International Thriller Writers Association. Sandra is a lifelong Texan, and I'll start the interview with a Texas-centric question about her new title, Friction. Sandra, welcome back to the Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine. Always a pleasure.
For your readers who are not Texans, how is a Texas Ranger different from, for example, a member of the police department?
Well, Texas Rangers have such a lore surrounding them. Their history is quite fascinating, and they used to be just about the only law enforcement agency in Texas, but as crime and law enforcement has become specialized, their numbers have dwindled, and now there are just about 180 of them. But when you consider the size of the state, that's pretty an elite force spread very thin, and they have total autonomy. They work under the auspices of the Department of Public Safety, but they can initiate an investigation without any consideration to jurisdiction. They have statewide jurisdiction, and they can walk into any other agency and say, we want to look at this, and they can do it. So I thought it would be very interesting to write about one who has that kind of clout.
Well, it was. Crawford Hunt is your Texas Ranger, whom you describe as a Dirty Harry kind of cop. How so?
Well, he's known for acting instinctually. He gets the job done. He doesn't always wait to get permission to do something, and for that reason, I thought he would be an interesting character.
You know, I love that Crawford's last name is Hunt because he spends his days tracking down the bad guys.
Right.
How do you name your characters? When you hit upon a name, do you run it by your husband, colleagues? How do you name characters?
Sometimes I have friends who save me names.
Oh.
They'll recommend a name. And I recently had someone say, oh, so-and-so's uncle, and he gave a name, and I went, That's a great name. I'm going to put it in a book. so I kind of collect names, but when I was writing Crawford, I actually put that down as a last name, and I looked at it for a minute, and I thought, no, I like that for a first name. And then because I needed a one-syllable name, I thought the two went together. But I have, Elaine, in the past given a name to a character, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't match. Their personality will start emerging as I'm writing the book, and I'm going, that name no longer fits. And so I will go back and change the name rather than change their personality, because they let me know who they are.
Of course, when you read a book, you envision the characters in your head. I saw Crawford as dark, brooding, dark, dark hair, dark eyes. So it kind of threw me midway through the book when you wrote about his blonde hair. Do your readers often disagree with you as to how they picture your characters?
Well, it's interesting, but I also love that. I love the fact that you imprinted your own image on him. I think a character's outward appearance, hair color, eye color, is not nearly as important as what makes them tick. And so I love that you had a mental image of him that really had nothing to do with his outward appearance. And I often have fans who will say, oh, if this is made into a movie, I'd love to see so-and-so, you know, play the character. And I'll think, now that's interesting, you know, that they saw Daniel Craig in the role. I find it interesting the people that, the faces that they kind of superimpose over the character.
We're speaking with Sandra Brown on The Book Report. Introduce us to Holly Spencer.
Well, I loved Holly because she did play by the book. She wanted to do everything right. And the book is really much more of a moral dilemma for her than it is for Crawford, because he's accustomed to rule breaking and getting in trouble, and he's kind of reconciled himself to it. He's trying to walk the straight and narrow, but he knows it kind of goes against his nature. In fact, Holly, by contrast, was born the good girl. She's done everything right. She's not become a judge for nothing. She's very smart, very judicious, into her marrow. And so enter this situation in which she does compromise, and it totally goes against her grain. So I had a good time watching that struggle because I could kind of relate, because I was the good girl growing up, you know, and now I get to do bad things through my characters, you know, vicariously, but I got her, I related to her. And she sees that, and she even says this in a piece of dialogue. She even says, you know, before Crawford, I saw everything in black and white. Now I see, you know, there are shades of gray. And so I liked that struggle in her.
A custody case is central to the book Friction. When researching it, did you get input from family law judges and attorneys?
I did. I've become good friends, social friends, with a family court judge where we live. And she's always talking about, you know, these fascinating cases, and she did this and she did that, and, you know, what she said. Of course, no names, but, I mean, she's telling stories. And so I thought, well, she'd be a good person to ask about this. So I called her up one day. I was telling her what I was doing, and I said, so, okay, how compromising on ethics, how unethical would it be? And I kind of outlined this situation, and she said, oh, it'd be highly unethical. And I went, oh, really? And she said, oh, but go ahead and write it. She said, judges do unethical things all the time.
You know, I kind of loved Conrad, who is Crawford's dad.
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
Oh, I loved him, too. I needed to give Crawford a sounding board that would tell him everything that he did not want to hear. And I didn't know in the first scene between the two of them that he was going to turn out to be who he was. I just thought that he might have been another Texas Ranger, or he might have been, you know, a prosecutor or a cop or somebody that had kind of mentored Crawford before he went on the skids. But then at the end of the scene, I thought, ah, this makes it better. And but I loved him because he's so savvy. He's so canny. And he, as I said, he tells Crawford all the things that he needs to hear but that he doesn't want to hear, and yet Crawford continues to kind of ask his advice about things.
So is it more fun to write a bad guy, like in this case, Chuck Otterman, or is it easier to write the hero?
Well, it's all hard. None of it's easy. But I have... that's a difficult question because I have to admire my protagonist. I mean, I've got to live with these people for a long time. Having said that, it's often a whole lot more fun to write the villain because you don't have to be moral. You don't have to think of the rightness and wrongness of it. If they do something evil, then it's part of their character. If the protagonist does something that's a little on the iffy side, you have to justify it. So in that way, you can kind of let loose on the villain in a way that I wouldn't let loose on the protagonist.
All right. So are you already at work on a new book?
Yes.
When can we expect it?
Oh, it'll be next summer at this time. Yeah, it'll be next August.
Okay. And are there any recurring characters that we might be familiar with?
No. You know, Elaine, I've never really been interested in a series or a recurring character. I like to finish up the story. In this case, I felt like Friction ended the way it needed to. It had a satisfactory ending. And so now I'm ready to go on to the next set of characters in the next story.
Well, I have to say, Friction was quite the page turner. Sandra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your having me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Bye, Sandra.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Friction, performed by Stephen Lang.
He showered with customary efficiency, but took a little more time than usual on personal grooming, flossing, shaving extra close, using a blow dryer rather than letting his hair dry naturally. But he was no good at wielding the dryer, and his hair came out looking the same as it always did, unmanageable. Why hadn't he thought to get a trim? He noticed a few gray strands in his sideburns. They, plus the faint lines at the corners of his eyes and on either side of his mouth, lent him an air of maturity. But the judge would probably regard them as signs of hard living. Impatient with his self-scrutiny, he turned away from the bathroom mirror and went into his bedroom to dress. He had considered wearing a suit, but figured that would be going overboard, like he was trying too hard to impress the judge. Besides, the navy wool blend made him feel like an undertaker. He settled for a sport jacket and tie. Although the small of his back missed the pressure of his holster, he decided not to carry. In the kitchen, he brewed coffee and poured himself a bowl of cereal, but neither settled well in his nervous stomach, so he dumped them into the disposal. As the Cheerios vaporized, he got a call from his lawyer. "You all right?" The qualities that made William Moore a good lawyer worked against him as a likable human being. He possessed little grace and zero charm, so, although he'd called to ask about Crawford's state of mind, the question sounded like a challenge, to which he expected a positive answer. "Doing okay. Court will convene promptly at 2:00. "Right. Wish it was earlier. Are you going into your office first?" "Thought about it, maybe. I don't know." "You should. Work will keep your mind off the hearing." Crawford hedged. "I'll see how the morning goes." "Nervous?" "No." The attorney snorted with skepticism. Crawford admitted to experiencing a few butterflies. "We've gone over it," the lawyer said. "Look everyone in the eye, especially the judge. Be sincere. You'll do fine." Although it sounded easy enough, Crawford released a long breath. At this point, I've done everything I can. It's now up to the judge, whose mind is probably already made up. Maybe, maybe not. The decision could hinge on how you comport yourself on the stand. Crawford frowned into the phone. But no pressure. I have a good feeling. Better than the other kind, I guess, but what happens if I don't win today? What do I do next, short of taking out a contract on Judge Spencer? Don't even think in terms of losing. When Crawford didn't respond, Moore began to lecture. The last thing we need is for you to slink into court looking pessimistic. Right. I mean it. If you look unsure, you're sunk. Right. Go in there with confidence, certainty, like you've already kicked butt. I've got it, okay? Responding to his client's testiness, Moore backed down. I'll meet you outside the courtroom a little before 2. He hung up without saying goodbye. With hours to kill before he had to be in court, Crawford wandered through his house, checking things. Fridge, freezer, and pantry were well stocked. He'd had a maid service come in yesterday, and the 3 industrious women had left the whole house spotless. He tidied his bathroom and made his bed. He didn't see anything else he could improve upon. Last, he went into the 2nd bedroom, the one he'd spent weeks preparing for George's homecoming, not allowing himself to think that from tonight forward, his little girl wouldn't be spending every night under his roof. He'd left the decorating up to the saleswoman at the furniture store. George is 5 years old, about to start kindergarten. She asked, "Favorite color?" "Pink." "Second favorite, pink." "Do you have a budget?" "Knock yourself out." She'd taken him at his word. Everything in the room was pink, except for the creamy white headboard, chest of drawers, and vanity table with an oval mirror that swiveled between upright spindles. He had added touches he thought Georgia would like, picture books with pastel covers featuring rainbows and unicorns and such.
We've just heard Friction by Sandra Brown. FBI agent Nicholas Drummond and his partner Mike Kane are deep into an investigation of the COE, Celebrants of the Earth, a violent group known for widespread bombings of power grids and oil refineries. While investigating a tip about a possible bombing plot, New Jersey's Bayway refinery explodes. Nicholas and Mike race to the scene and are nearly killed by a secondary device. The pair seek out the tipster and discover that he and the FBI team left to guard him are dead. While at the murder scene, the COE strikes again, this time launching a cyber attack on several oil companies that drains their financial and intellectual assets. But COE has been infiltrated by a deep-cover counterterrorism agent named Vanessa Grace. A bomb-making expert, Vanessa joins forces with Nicholas and Mike to stop the organization's devious plan to assassinate the president. Renee Rodman and McLeod Andrews share the narration.
FBI Special Agent Michaela Kane drove the black Crown Vic with one hand, tucked a hank of loose hair back into her ponytail with the other, then shoved up her glasses. It was late, and she was tired, ready to go home and crash, but no chance, since they'd gotten a credible tip off the hotline. She looked over at her partner, Special Agent Nicholas Drummond, tapping on a laptop balanced on his knees, doing a background check on their tipster. "I'm praying with all my might we're not on a wild goose chase and this guy isn't a thrill chaser." Nicholas looked up.
"I'm inclined to think he isn't. Ben said the man was convinced he had information on COE and a possible bombing. At this point, I'm willing to listen to anyone, even if it means missing one of Nigel's dinners. He called me earlier, said it was prime rib."
Mike laughed. "Oh my. That sounds even better than the scrumptious 3-day-old chicken salad sandwich I was planning to have at home." She paused, then sighed. "We've been working this case for 2 weeks now, Nicholas, and gotten nowhere. I hate that. Several oil refineries out west, and no leads. I only wish we could keep the frequent flyer miles earned from flying all over the country. And what do we have? This group's mission statement, over and over, the same thing. No more oil from terrorist countries, or you will pay the price. And now, out of nowhere, this guy pops up in our own backyard with information on COE? On a possible bombing? Do you really think this Hodges character is for real? He looked over at her.
My gut is starting to agree with my brain and say yes. You know what else? I think it's also about time that we have our turn at bat.
Baseball metaphor from a Brit? No, he probably meant cricket. Were you at bat in cricket? She didn't know. She grinned. Either way, he was right. It was their turn, and if Hodges was for real, it was possible they'd have a chance for a home run. Nicholas looked back at his laptop.
Mr. Hodges appears solid, an accountant for a local Bayonne engineering firm. His wife died 3 years ago. Breast cancer. She took a left into an older residential neighborhood, thick with trees and small, well-manicured lawns. Mr. Richard Hodges's house was on a quiet, dead-end cul-de-sac that backed up to the Hudson River. To Nicholas, the block looked like any other older development in a small eastern American town. 30-year-old single-story house, comfortably settled in with their neighbors. Amazing how quiet it was, considering its proximity to Manhattan. He supposed the lapping water dampened the sound. They saw the curtains twitch. Nicholas closed his laptop. I see we're expected. Mike turned off the engine.
Okay. I'm thinking positively. I'm up at bat, and Mr. Hodges is going to give me a perfect pitch. The door opened before they had a chance to ring the bell. A man, dressed in jeans and a white polo shirt, waved them in and closed the door quietly behind them, as if he didn't want to wake someone. A habit from when his wife was ill? The interior of Mr. Hodges's house was neat, looked clean, but it smelled musty, somehow sterile, and Mike doubted there'd been another woman living here since his wife's death. She didn't see any photos or knickknacks on any surface, only piles of newspapers and news magazines. The house, she realized, was now only a place where a lonely man lived off his memories.
That was The Endgame by Catherine Coulter with J.T. Ellison. The Sleeper by Emily Barr is a tense psychological thriller with Hitchcockian overtones. Lara Finch is living a lie. Everyone thinks she has a happy life in Cornwall, married to the devoted Sam. But in fact, she's desperately bored. When she's offered a new job that involves commuting to London by sleeper train, she meets Guy and starts an illicit affair. Then Lara vanishes from the night train without a trace. Only her friend Iris doubts the official version of events and sets out to find her. For Iris, it is the start of a voyage that will take her to a trail of old crimes and dark secrets. For Lara, it's the end of a journey that started a long time ago, a journey she must finish before it destroys her. Imogen Church performs the book.
He stands next to me on the balcony and hands me this green mug his horrible mother gave me for Christmas. A train pulls into the station below us. It has two carriages, and thus is the biggest train that will fit alongside that platform. One cup of tea, he says with mock ceremony, and I try not to flinch. I hope it meets with Madame's approval. It does not. But I cannot, of course, say so. I cradle it in both hands and try to arrange my features into the right expression. He knows which mugs I like, and he knows that this is emphatically not one of them. I cannot tell him that I care about such trivialities. He would pantomime wide-eyed, reasonable surprise. Thanks, I say. Our forearms touch as we lean on the rail and we look out across the town. The sun is shining on the train in the station, the docks behind it, the town curved beyond them, hugging the harbour. Light glints off the water out there, and tiny, dazzling spots of brightness come and go with the movement of the waves. On the other side of the estuary, the trees and fields and mansions of Flushing are glowing in the heat, unusual even for August. Seagulls stand in formation on the roof of one of the warehouses down at the docks. They are doing the bird equivalent of sunbathing. The almost uncomfortable heat on my skin, the salt in the air which I normally don't notice, the glimmer of the sun on the water all make me think, suddenly, of long-forgotten childhood holidays. "It looks like a picture from a children's book, doesn't it?" I say. "Station? Container ships? Warships? Sailing boats? Cars? Lorries? There should be words written underneath it." I place them with my hand under the station car park. "How many different forms of transport can you see?" He is staring at me, not at the things I am pointing at, so I turn my head to look at him.
"Yes," he says. "And those grabby things?"
He gestures to the equipment at the docks.
"And the huge metal things that lift stuff. It's picture book heaven."
I reach out and touch his arm. The hairs on it are springy and blonde. Even this exchange has taken us too close to the topic that I am trying to avoid, just because there is nothing more to be said about it. I change the subject, sipping my tea, which, as it so often is about half the strength I would make it myself, and gesture at the houses over to our left. "And over there, how many different lives can we see? Thousands of homes, all those windows, all the things that go on behind them. I bet there's weirder stuff happening out there than you could possibly imagine." He squints at the houses.
"Then I could, or anyone."
"Anyone?" I clarify, possibly too quickly. Sam shifts his cup of tea into his other hand and puts an arm around my shoulders. I lean into him. He is big, like a bear, broad but not fat. I have always liked that about him. While I recoil from the idea of being the sort of woman who wants a big, strong man to look after her, I do, nonetheless, enjoy his solidity. "You remember that my friend's coming over this afternoon?" I say. "The one I met on the ferry?"
"Oh, yeah, you did say. What's her name again?"
"Iris."
"Yes, Iris."
We've just heard The Sleeper by Emily Barr. Born to a prominent Chicago judge and his stifled socialite wife, Mia Dennett moves against the grain as a young inner-city art teacher. One night, Mia enters a bar to meet her on-again, off-again boyfriend. But when he doesn't show, she unwisely leaves with an enigmatic stranger. With his smooth moves and modest wit, Colin Thatcher seems at first like a safe one-night stand. But in Mary Kubica's The Good Girl, following Colin home will turn out to be the worst mistake of Mia's life. Colin's job was to abduct Mia as part of a wild extortion plot and deliver her to his employers. But the plan takes an unexpected turn when Colin suddenly decides to hide Mia in a secluded cabin. Mia's mother, Eve, and Detective Gabe Hoffman will stop at nothing to find them, but no one could have predicted the emotional entanglements that eventually cause this family's world to shatter. An ensemble cast performs the book.
"I don't know much about her. I've seen a snapshot. It's a blurry photo of her stepping off the L platform, taken by a car parked a dozen or so feet away. There are about 10 people between the photographer and the girl, and so her face has been circled with a red pen. On the back of the photograph are the words, 'Mia Dennett,' and an address. It was handed to me a week or so ago. I've never done anything like this before. Larceny, yes. Harassment, yes. Not kidnapping. But I need the money. I've been following her for the last few days. I know where she buys her groceries, where she has her dry cleaning done, where she works. I've never spoken to her. I wouldn't recognize the sound of her voice. I don't know the color of her eyes or what they look like when she's scared. But I will. I carry a beer, but I don't drink it. I can't risk getting drunk. Not tonight. But I don't want to draw attention to myself, and so I order the beer so I'm not empty-handed. She's fed up when the call comes in on her cell phone. She steps outside to take the call, and when she comes back, she's frustrated. She thinks about leaving, but decides to finish her drink. She finds a pen in her purse and doodles on a bar napkin, listening to some read poetry on stage. I try not to think about it. I try not to think about the fact that she's pretty. I remind myself of the money. I need the money. This can't be that hard. In a couple hours, it will all be through. It's good, I say, nodding at the napkin. It's the best I can come up with. I know nothing about art. She gives me the cold shoulder when I first approach. She doesn't want a thing to do with me. That makes it easier. She barely lifts her eyes from the napkin even when I praise the candle she's drawn. She wants me to leave her alone. Thanks. She doesn't look at me. Kind of abstract. This is apparently the wrong thing to say. You think it looks like... Another man would laugh. He'd say he was kidding and kill her with compliments. But not me. Not with her. I slide into the booth. Any other girl, any other day, I'd walk away. Any other day, I wouldn't have approached her table in the first place. I leave small talk and flirting and all that other to someone else. I didn't say it looked like... She sets her hand on her coat. I was about to leave, she says. She swallows the rest of her drink and sets the glass on the table. The booth is all yours. Like Monet, I say. Monet does that abstract stuff, doesn't he? I say it on purpose. She looks at me. I'm sure it's the first time. I smile. I wonder if what she sees is enough to lift her hand from the coat. Her tone softens and she knows she's been abrupt. Maybe not so bitchy after all. Maybe just off. Monet is an impressionist painter, she says. Picasso, that's abstract art. Kandinsky, Jackson Pollock. I've never heard of them. She still plans to leave. I'm not worried. If she decides to leave, I'll follow her home. I know where she lives. And I have plenty of time. But I try anyway. I reach for the napkin that she's crumpled and set in an ashtray. I dust off the ashes and unfold it. It doesn't look like, I say to her, as I fold it and slide it into the back pocket of my jeans. This is enough to send her eyes roving the bar for the waitress. She thinks she'll have another drink. You're keeping that? She asks. Yes. She laughs. In case I'm famous one day? People like to feel as if they're important. She lets it get the best of her.
We've just heard The Good Girl by Mary Kubica. My name is Nikki Frank. I'm in a hospital after crashing my car. I'm afraid. The only thing I can think about is Vero. I know I have to save her, but why couldn't I find her? She's just a little girl. This is how Lisa Gardner sets the scene in Crash and Burn. The man standing in my hospital room tells me we are married, but there's no Vero. That 6 months ago, I suffered TBI, which caused changes to my personality. I have dramatic mood swings, an inability to concentrate, large gaps in my memory. I'm quick to anger, and I drink. all of which, he says, explains the car accident and my confusion. Now a man named Sergeant Wyatt Foster is investigating. He has questions about the car accident. He has concerns about my husband, and he's worried about a missing girl. He would like to know what happened to me. So would I. My name is Nikki Frank. This is my life. Watch me crash and burn. Jennifer Woodward performs the book.
Then, my gaze still struggling to take in my surroundings, I spy glass fragments scattered around me, the remains of a bottle. I should move, get out, call someone, do something. My head hurts so damn much, and instead of velvet black sky, I see bursting white lights exploding across my field of vision. Vero. One word. It rises to the front of my mind, grounding me, guiding me, urging me forward. Vero, Vero, Vero. I move. Laboriously. The keening sound replaced by a soul-wrenching scream as I attempt to extricate myself from the driver's seat. My vehicle appears to have landed on its front end, the dash nearly crushed against me. I'm not upright, but tilted forward, as if my Audi, once it broke its nose, couldn't regain its balance. It means I have to work doubly hard to unpin myself from the accordionized space between my seat and the steering wheel and collapsed dash. Airbag. The excess mass wraps around my arms, tangles up my hands, and I curse it. Back to screaming and fighting and ranting gibberish. But the senseless rage spikes my adrenaline until at least the crushing fatigue is gone. And now there is only pain. An endless, terrible pain I already understand I can't afford to contemplate. As I finally wiggle my way sideways from between the driver's seat and the dash, I collapse, panting heavily, onto the center console. Legs work, arms too, heads on fire. Vero. Smoke. Do I smell smoke? I suffer an immediate bolt of panic. Smoke, screams, fire. Smoke, screams, fire. Vero, Vero, Vero. Run! No. I catch myself. No smoke. That was the first time. How many times can a woman die? I'm not sure. It's a blur in my head, from the smell of wet earth to the heat of flames, all separate and yet together. I am dying. I am dead. No, I am merely dying. No, wait. I am dead. The first time, the second time, the third. I can't sort it out. Only one thing matters, has ever mattered. Vero. I must save Vero. Back seat. I twist myself around. I hit first my left knee, then my right, and scream again. Don't care. Back seat. I have to get to the back seat. I fumble around in the dark, licking rain and mud from my lips as other impressions start to register. The windshield is shattered, but also the moonroof, hence the inside rain. My once gorgeous, relatively new and luxurious Audi Q5 crossover SUV has been shortened by at least a foot, if not two. The front end sustaining the worst of the impact, and the front doors most likely too warped to open. But the back appears to be relatively intact. Vero. 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 I realize for the first time I am wearing gloves. Or used to be wearing gloves. The glass has shredded them into large, bloody flaps that hinder my movements. I wrestle the first one off, then the second, then jam them self-consciously in my pants pocket. Can't toss them on the floor. That would be littering, and I treat my car better than that. Used to treat my car better than that. My head hurts so damn much. I want to curl up in a ball and sleep and sleep and sleep. But I don't. I can't. Vero.
That was Crash and Burn by Lisa Gardner. Let's end today's Ladies in the Lineup with a just-released title from Robert Galbraith. What? Wait a minute. Robert? How does he fit into our show? Of course, we all know that Robert Galbraith is none other than J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame. In the just-released Career of Evil, a mysterious package is delivered to Robin Ellicott. When she opens it, she's horrified to discover it contains a woman's severed leg. Her boss, Private Detective Cormoran Strike, is less surprised, but no less alarmed. There are four people from his past who he thinks would be responsible, and Strike knows any one of them is capable of sustained and unspeakable brutality. With the police focusing on the wrong guy, Strike and Robin take matters into their own hands and delve into the dark and twisted worlds of the other three men. But as more horrendous acts occur, time is running out for the two of them.
Robin Ellicott was 26 years old and had been engaged for over a year. Her wedding ought to have taken place 3 months previously, but the unexpected death of her future mother-in-law had led to the ceremony's postponement. Much had happened during the 3 months since the wedding should have happened. Would she and Matthew have been getting on better if vows had been exchanged, she wondered? Would they be arguing less if a golden band was sitting beneath the sapphire engagement ring that had become a little loose on her finger? Fighting her way through the rubble on Tottenham Court Road on Monday morning, Robin mentally relived the argument of the previous day. The seeds had been sown before they had even left the house for the rugby. Every time they met up with Sarah Shadlock and her boyfriend Tom, Robin and Matthew seemed to row, something that Robin had pointed out as the argument, which had been brewing since the match, dragged on into the small hours of the morning. Sarah was stirring, for God's sake. Can't you see it? She was the one asking all about him, going on and on. I didn't start it. The everlasting roadworks around Tottenham Court Road station had obstructed Robin's walk to work ever since she had started at the private detective agency in Denmark Street. Her mood was not improved by tripping on a large chunk of rubble. She staggered a few steps before recovering her balance. A barrage of wolf whistles and lewd remarks issued from a deep chasm in the road full of men in hard hats and fluorescent jackets. Shaking long strawberry blonde hair out of her eyes, red in the face, she ignored them, her thoughts returning irresistibly to Sarah Shadlock and her sly, persistent questions about Robin's boss. "He is strangely attractive, isn't he? Bit beaten up looking, but I've never minded that. Is he sexy in the flesh? He's a big guy, isn't he?" Robin had seen Matthew's jaw tightening as she tried to return cool, indifferent answers. "Is it just the two of you in the office? Is it really? Nobody else at all?" thought Robin, whose habitual good nature had never stretched to Sarah Shadlock. She knew exactly what she was doing. "Is it true he was decorated in Afghanistan? Is it? Wow! So we're talking a war hero, too." Robin had tried her hardest to shut down Sarah's one-woman chorus of appreciation for Cormoran Strike, but to no avail. A coolness had crept into Matthew's manner towards his fiancée by the end of the match. His displeasure had not prevented him bantering and laughing with Sarah on the journey back from Vicarage Road, though, and Tom, whom Robin found boring and obtuse, had chortled away, oblivious to any undercurrents. Jostled by passers-by, also navigating the open trenches in the road, Robin finally reached the opposite pavement, passing beneath the shadow of the concrete grid-like monolith that was Centre Point, and becoming angry all over again as she remembered what Matthew had told her at midnight, when the argument had burst back into flame. "You can't stop bloody talking about him, can you? I heard you to Sarah. I did not start talking about him again. It was her. You weren't listening." But Matthew had imitated her, using the generic voice that stood for all women, high-pitched and imbecilic,
Oh, his hair's so lovely.
For God's sake, you're completely bloody paranoid, Robin had shouted. Sarah was banging on about Jacques Berger's bloody hair, not cormorants, and all I said,
not cormorants,
he had repeated in that moronic squeal. As Robin rounded the corner into Denmark Street, she felt as furious as she had 8 hours ago, when she had stormed out of the bedroom to sleep on the sofa. Sarah Shadlock. Bloody Sarah Shadlock. Who had been at university with Matthew and had tried as hard as she could to win him away from Robin, the girl left behind in Yorkshire. If Robin could have been sure she would never see Sarah again, she would have rejoiced. But Sarah would be at their wedding in July. Sarah would doubtless continue to plague their married life, and perhaps one day she would try to worm her way into Robin's office to meet Strike, if her interest was genuine and not merely a means of sowing discord between Robin and Matthew.
We've just heard Career of Evil by Robert Galbraith. Readers, I hope you found some can't-miss stories to add to your fall reading list in today's lineup. Be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for great titles across the genres. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.